The rules of trade, property, and exchange have become the determining mechanisms of society. Decoupling focus from actual life-supporting means and factors of social trust, the dehumanized, conflict-ridden nature of the modern world begins to make a lot more sense. Given this ethic, education is simply another product to be bought and sold and little more. The U.S. government allocates roughly 2% of its annual budget to education. This is in stark contrast to the 20% allocated to the military, suggesting war is more beneficial to the nation's leaders than an educated population. At any rate, with the minimum debt payments from my student loan mounting, I quickly sought whatever work I could find. Within a few weeks, I found myself in the glamorous field of work as a cater waiter. In comparison to traditional restaurant work, this job consisted of being bussed around New York City from one privileged upper-class event to another. We were an army of servants in tuxedos, following the wealthy 1% around the Big Apple. While certain traditional functions had endearing merit, such as weddings and birthdays, the majority were corporate political events and superficial charity fundraisers. I say superficial because if the goal of charity is to help those in need, you certainly wouldn't know it based on the degree of waste and decadence present. There is something fundamentally wrong when people are eating extravagant meals, wearing $5,000 suits, and drinking $800 bottles of champagne while a guy on stage preaches about global starvation and poverty. This is particularly troubling in New York City, a place with about 60,000 homeless on the street each night. Nevertheless, it was certainly an education to be a fly on the wall. At one event, executives from the Walt Disney Corporation were being honored for both their apparent philanthropy and record profits, explaining how they were bringing needed jobs to impoverished people in Bangladesh and Haiti. It wasn't long after I saw Disney exposed on the news for facilitating some of the worst human rights abuses in sweatshop labor history, paying as little as 4 cents an hour, denying basic labor rights and benefits, tolerating the beating of workers for failing to meet quotas, sexual harassment, using children as labor, and more. It's a unique state of mind when a company moves operations to impoverished areas of the world, exploiting the vulnerable for cheap labor, only to then try and convince themselves and others they are doing the region a favor. In the end, during this time as a cater waiter, I was able to see a side of society I think most do not. Coming from a lower middle class upbringing, my father a postman and my mother a social worker, I had little exposure to such privilege. What I came to realize is that there is often a distinct detachment from reality in wealthy culture. It wasn't that these folks were overtly disrespectful or mean. Most were quite polite when dealing with the help. Sometimes I would end up at mansions and exotic penthouse apartments, serving as a family's personal servant for the evening. These were generally kind people and clearly caring when it came to their home life. Still, a clear disconnect from general society was obvious, a kind of cultural alienation, if you will. Given the access the wealthy have to means and conveniences that most do not, coupled with different social atmospheres and other cultural nuances, this alienation isn't difficult to understand. In the same way we can understand why the Amish tend to isolate themselves as a community, the rich tend to do the same, losing touch with the plight of the normal world. Rather than simply demonize the wealthy, it is important that we realize they are victims of circumstance and groomed into their characteristic worldviews and behaviors by larger order forces like everyone else. They are only partially responsible for their actions, as expressed in this chapter. This fact is important, for viewing society through this system-oriented lens is needed to better understand the true nature of class conflict. It is also needed to establish a new level of compassion toward others. There is little value in group versus group thinking, as the real problem is not the nature of any group, but how that group manifested its values and biases to begin with. I view those whose values and worldview are distorted by power and wealth as little different from those suffering from any other biopsychosocial derangement of culture. In the same way, we can expect certain social preconditions to lead to problematic outcomes within the lower class, such as street gangs, crime, and violence. Similar sociological processes all too often lead the rich to develop selfish, apathetic, and power-hungry behaviors. Social psychology. As F. Scott Fitzgerald cogently wrote, "Let me tell you about the very rich. They are different from you and me. They think, deep in their hearts, that they are better than we are because we had to discover the compensation and refuges of life for ourselves. Even when they enter deep into our world or sink below us, they still think that they are better than we are. They are different." Social status is not just about material access and social privilege. Our sense of rank has a deep impact on our self-identity. It doesn't have to be money that creates the difference, but in the world today, this is by far the most defining cultural modulator. And the unsettling truth is that there are, on average, pronounced psychological differences between upper and lower classes. Confidence and self-esteem is an example. As was touched upon in the preceding chapter with respect to in-group, out-group associations, our social nature is a feedback system, and how we perceive ourselves is inexplicably linked to others. In a 2004 study focusing on two different ranking social castes, birth classes, in India, it was found that if the whole combined group did not know they were a mix of two castes, their performance on problem-solving tests was different from the results when they did know. When the caste was not announced, the two castes performed basically the same on the test. When the caste was announced, the lower caste did far worse. This study is one of many confidence studies showing that if people feel inferior and lower in value, they very well may act that way, losing confidence. This is called the Gollum effect, and it has been widely researched. There are also measurable neurobiological effects of perceived social status. In a 2002 study with macaque monkeys, it was found that those in lower ranks had less dopamine activity in the brain as compared with those in upper ranks. This effect would then change when the monkeys were strategically regrouped. When lower status monkeys assumed higher status positions, they had more dopamine activity, while the prior alphas had less. This shows a direct correlation between perceived social rank and biological expression, a pretty damning link that reveals public health ramifications to social status in a very clear way. Reduced dopamine activity can lead to serious psychological and emotional effects, including depression, loss of motivation, anxiety, attention problems, and other problems. What such studies also highlight is how psychological traits can be consequential to a social condition as opposed to determinant. In other words, when people see the confidence, will, motivation, apparent intelligence, and other virtuous traits celebrated as characteristic of the rich and successful, superficial reasoning suggests that they gained their financial success owing to those traits. While that may be true at times, the biopsychosocial reality is that those traits also arise from the mere privilege of simply being in a high-class, respected, and rewarded position to begin with. Hence, one's sense of status can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Perhaps more troubling are differences in empathy and compassion between the upper and lower classes. A 2010 study found that higher-class individuals actually had a more difficult time recognizing emotions in others. It appears the lower class develops more perceptive social skills than the upper, including the ability to better recognize emotional details in others, making empathic connections. One of the study's researchers concluded, "Upper-class people, in spite of all their advantages, suffer empathy deficits. And there are enormous consequences." Likewise, numerous studies examining differences in compassion suggests that the more one's bank account increases, the less compassionate he or she becomes. In a paper titled Having Less, Giving More, The Influence of Social Class on Pro-Social Behavior, the relative poor were found to give over twice as much to charity as the relative rich in percentage terms. The study also stated, lower-class individuals proved to be more generous, charitable, trusting, and helpful compared with their upper-class counterparts. Mediator and moderator data showed that lower-class individuals acted in a more pro-social fashion because of a greater commitment to egalitarian values and feelings of compassion. A similar study by the Chronicle of Philanthropy showed that household earnings between $50,000 and $75,000 a year give an average of 7.6% of their discretionary income to charity, while those making more than $100,000 gave only 4.2%. In some of the wealthiest neighborhoods with the largest share of people making in excess of $200,000 a year, the average giving rate was only 2.8%. In the words of Ken Stern, writing for The Atlantic, one of the most surprising and perhaps confounding facts of charity in America is that the people who can least afford to give are the ones who donate the greatest percentage of their income. In 2011, the wealthiest Americans, those with earnings in the top 20%, contributed on average 1.3% of their income to charity. By comparison, Americans at the base of the income pyramid, those in the bottom 20%, donated 3.2% of their income. Again, while these percentage numbers may seem small, 1.3% to 3.2% actually means the poor are giving well over twice the amount in percentage terms. I remember going to work early one winter morning, riding the subway into Manhattan from Brooklyn. An older homeless man was making his way through the mostly empty train car, pausing in front of me as I scrounged for whatever change I could put into his empty cup. After I dropped in 2 quarters, the man thanked me and moved on. At the other side of the train was a clearly poor woman, bundled up and appearing to try to sleep. The man shuffled along as though to pass her, only to stop and make eye contact. After a brief moment of interaction, he reached into his cup and took out one of the 2 quarters and gave it to her. I was stunned to see the compassion. While I did not know the man's circumstance, there is good reason to assume that with that act of charity, he actually gave away 50% of all the money he had in the world to a stranger. While today many fawn over the billions given by this or that wealthy icon, the real measure of compassion has to do with how giving affects you personally, and that is why the percentage people give is more telling than the absolute values. Sociological research also suggests that something happens to people's ethics as they move up the economic ladder. While there are always exceptions, a general loss of social concern appears common. In a 2011 study from the University of California, Berkeley, it was found that upper-class individuals behave more unethically than lower-class individuals. Upper-class individuals were more likely to break the law while driving relative to lower-class individuals. In follow-up laboratory studies, upper-class individuals were more likely to exhibit unethical decision-making tendencies, take valued goods from others, lie in negotiation, cheat to increase their chances of winning a prize, and endorse unethical behavior at work than were lower-class individuals. Mediator and moderator data demonstrated that upper-class individuals' unethical tendencies are accounted for, in part, by their more favorable attitudes toward greed. It has been something of a historical cliché that those who achieve great financial success in business tend to be ruthless or desensitized. It has even been said that the more caring and empathic you are, the less likely you are to succeed in capitalism. It appears the Ebenezer Scrooge phenomenon is not far off the mark, as per modern social science. Given the self-interested focus required in economic competition, increasingly rewarded as one climbs the socioeconomic ladder, it makes sense that such disassociated values become dominant. Detached from the plight of the lower class, the rich begin to think the padded world they experience is the world everyone else experiences. In other words, people in the lower classes are more attuned to the common suffering and hence more compassionate. Some call this the empathy gap, embracing both the lack of exposure the rich have to the plight of the common folk and the psychological changes that reinforce social indifference. Needless to say, it doesn't bode well for general society when those of great wealth and resulting power tend to have a propensity to be indifferent and apathetic. Another feature of this phenomenon is the relationship between the degree of apathy and selfishness and the prevailing socioeconomic climate. The United States is a unique case for observing this, given its status as a kind of forbidden experiment in class extremity and material culture. During the Great Recession, it was found that those who made more than $200,000 a year donated 5% less than in prior years, while those who made $25,000 or less a year actually increased giving by 17%. The proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found that as income inequality increases, the wealthy tend to give less. The research suggests that elite wealth concentration tends to lead to the belief that one is more important and deserving than others, and that resources rightly belong to them, in an increased sense of entitlement. This tendency has also been verified by an extensive lab study led by psychologist Paul Piff, who found that in a rigged game of Monopoly, with one player given more turns, more initial money, and every advantage ensuring an inevitable win, those winning subjects actually acted as though it was their cunning and smarts that led to the outcome when interviewed afterward. This finding has a clear parallel with the real world, where the social system, as will be further discussed in this chapter, provides great structural advantages to a small minority. People simply want to believe they are getting what they deserve, ignoring the unearned advantages they happen to have over others. Put bluntly by Piff, while having money doesn't necessarily make anybody anything, the rich are way more likely to prioritize their self-interests over the interests of other people. It makes them more likely to exhibit characteristics that would stereotypically associate with, say, assholes. There is also a correlation found between wealth status and what charitable causes donated money goes to. Unsurprisingly, the rich tend to give to elite schools, museums, symphonies, and other more tasteful interests on average, bypassing social welfare programs such as homelessness or poverty. In 2012, not one of the top 50 individual charitable gifts went to a social service organization or to a charity that principally serves the poor and the dispossessed. While it is true that in monetary terms the upper class gives more than the lower, even though substantially less in percentage terms, the fact that their focus tends to avoid core social welfare interests, favoring more luxury interests such as higher education, arts, and research, is certainly troubling. It isn't that those interests are not important, but with almost a billion people failing to meet basic daily nutritional requirements, we need to question the sense of priority. Philanthropy. It is interesting how the term philanthropy, defined as the desire to promote the welfare of others, has become associated almost exclusively with the wealthy, a badge worn to show how they give back to the community. Yet, rarely is the question of why there is the need to give back considered from the standpoint of market dynamics itself. While there is indeed growing global concern about increasing inequality, existing poverty, and so on, little real effort is being made to counter the problem from the standpoint of altering the social structure to correct what are clearly systemic problems inherent in our society. In fact, philanthropy appears to be the only practice to redistribute wealth that isn't met head-on with great disdain by the prevailing intelligentsia, especially in America. Even quite basic traditional platforms, such as increased taxation of the rich, are routinely met with contempt by gatekeepers of the capitalist religion. In the words of conservative Forbes contributor Jeffrey Dorfman, "Once you admit that income redistribution is fair, there is no logical stopping point short of communism." By this, Dorfman essentially implies that there is no stopping point short of everyone simply getting the exact same distribution of income, regardless of what job they perform. From there, of course, the gesture suggests this path can only lead to gulags, indifferent central planners, and the loss of individuality and liberty itself. This kind of anti-socialist dogma is nothing new, prominently set in motion in the early to mid-20th century when the threat of communism was putting capitalist hegemony at risk. The long-term consequence has been a reactionary Western culture that sees any direct government action toward economic equality, especially if it inconveniences the wealthy, as little more than a move toward bureaucratic tyranny. Not only does this bias vindicate the idea of philanthropy as the only acceptable solution to inequality and its consequences, but it also ignores the simple fact that the market economy is a process of wealth redistribution in and of itself. That is what the market does. It redistributes, literally, existing wealth and materials, whether raw, produced, recycled, financial, intellectual, or otherwise. As such, market dynamics cannot be merely assumed to be untouchable simply because its mechanics are seen as an objective process. In other words, it is deemed sacrilegious to impose equality-targeting taxation, since the market faith rests on the invisible hand of the market god to make everything okay. If this god is fallible, then the whole belief system becomes suspect. But there is nothing but evidence, formal and empirical, that the market god is horribly incompetent at best. Thomas Piketty, a French economist who became famous in 2014 for his treatment, Capital in the 21st Century, makes a strong case concluding that there is no way the growing global class divide can subside given the way capitalism is unfolding in its natural, financially liberalized state. The amount of money being made off existing wealth itself will continue to exceed what normal people make through labor income. High-level capital investment in the form of financial instruments such as stocks and other means are producing returns far exceeding anything the public can generate without such existing levels of wealth to invest. The technical term is the wealth-to-income ratio, and the higher it is, the worse off the general population. A 2015 Oxfam study found that by 2016, 1% of the global population will own more than the other 99% combined, with dire implications for related social problems. Piketty's proposal to stop this trend is the most expected one, a large progressive annual tax on wealth. Yet, even with this practical, commonplace attempt at a solution, the wealthy community quickly and expectedly condemned the idea. Most notable was the response by Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft, who is worth almost $80 billion and the richest person in the world as of 2015. He partly contested the idea of capital taxation since, in his view, philanthropy by the rich should be considered a viable institution in itself. He argues that those who choose to be philanthropic with their wealth should not be treated the same as wealthy folks who simply buy yachts and sports cars. While the gesture of this is respectable, given how Gates and his famous Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have indeed performed positive charitable acts, we need to step back and examine what he, along with an entire culture of high-level, big-money charities, are actually saying. Naturally, the main focus of society should be to solve problems directly, addressing root origins. In fact, I would argue that a true philanthropic desire to promote the welfare of others could only seek to alter the preconditions creating social problems to begin with. The ongoing need for social welfare charities is really a response to an inefficient economic system. It is a supplemental action to help those who are not as fortunate. The idea of turning this supplemental act of charity into an established social institution, deemed inclusive to the system of capitalism itself, implies that society is no longer to view outcomes such as poverty and other interests common to philanthropy as a real problem. Rather, it is a tacit admission that the resulting deprivation must be necessary, expected, and effectively accepted as just the way it is. Forget trying to change the preconditions leading to these problems. Let's just focus on giving back after the fact. That is the message, and it is a terrible one, as it avoids examining the structure of the economy itself. So, neither Piketty nor Gates offers actual solutions. Taxation, as suggested by Piketty, is only a patch, as it doesn't address the structural and systemic mechanisms that converge to create inequality. As with a car engine constantly leaking oil, you do not cover up the problem by continuing to refill the oil tank, pretending everything is fine. You fix the engine or replace it to stop the leaking. Gates, however, takes things to a new level by arguing he and other people of great wealth should simply use their charitable foundations to affect the disadvantaged world directly. Forget government, public policy, democracy, transparency, or even accountability. Private foundations built by billionaires will now save the world. While all charity is admirable, once it becomes institutionalized and funded to the extent seen by organizations such as the Gates Foundation, it turns into something different, with extended social ramifications. These elite charities are true large-scale institutions with power, engaging in lobbying, transnational partnerships, political policy alignments, and so on. Where and how the George Soroses and Bill Gates of the world mobilize money can have powerful effects on industry, politics, culture, academia, scientific research, national policy, and the like. In the case of Gates, his foundation is undeniably the most powerful and influential global health charity in history, in the words of health law professor Lawrence Gostin. What critics rightfully point out is that, regardless of good intentions, unaccountable, singular private power in global health affairs poses serious problems, in the same way autocratic dictatorships pose serious problems for democracy and liberty. Any organization with the power to actually affect the lives of millions of people needs transparency, accountability, and a democratic presence. These private institutions have little to none. So what we have is the rise of a new breed of pseudo-egalitarian capitalists. They generate their great wealth by way of often ruthless competitive behavior in the private sector, arguably promoting the very mechanisms that have led to the vast structural violence and extensive poverty existing on Earth to begin with. Then they turn around and offer their charity as the solution to the problems created by the very system that rewards them. Once again, this has nothing to do with intent. It is about an underlying hypocrisy that bypasses and obscures the real problem-solving focus desperately needed to further human rights justice. That focus can only be structural. At the same time, this institutionalization of philanthropy also serves to placate the public, giving a caring face to those who have often extracted such great wealth at the cost of others' well-being. In the words of activist Slavoj Žižek, charity is the humanitarian mask hiding the face of economic exploitation. As shown before with the research regarding how people tend to change as they gain more wealth and advantage, there is a deep psychological need in those of great wealth to feel that their exceptionalism is justified. They naturally wish not only to ensure everyone believes they deserve what they have, but also to justify it to themselves. An example of this is the Giving Pledge. wherein a group of more than 130 people, mostly billionaires, have promised to give half or more of their wealth to charity before or after their death. This now globally recognized project has been met with great humanitarian accolades in the media, especially given its timely creation as public outcry against inequality grows. Yet, it's very difficult not to view the entire project as a PR stunt for the upper 0.1%. As the organization states, "The pledge is a moral commitment to give, not a legal contract. It does not involve pooling money or supporting a particular set of causes or organizations." In other words, it is first and foremost a gesture, and no one signing the prestigious pledge has any obligation to do anything. There is also no transparency, so the public might never know whether a person gave or not. For those who do follow through, there are prominent tax incentives, specifically in the United States. Since donations to charity and philanthropic foundations allow for reduced tax liability for the rich, giving money away often becomes an act of strategic self-interest. Very often, the rich simply set up their own foundations and move money through them via tax loopholes. For example, the infamous Walton family, five people with a combined net wealth of over $139 billion as of 2014, more than what the bottom 40% of Americans have combined, do some fantastic tax gymnastics through their foundation. An independent audit of the Walton Family Foundation found that not only did only 0.04% of its wealth make it to charity in its generation's lifetime, but it also stated, "The Walmart heirs have built one of the largest and most powerful private foundations in the country at almost no cost to themselves. In addition, the Waltons are exploiting complex loopholes in the tax code in order to avoid billions of dollars in estate taxes by funding their foundation with special trusts." Estate taxes are interesting as they relate to the rich only. In the U.S., when people with more than $5.43 million die, the tax is 40% as of 2015. The rich work around this tax in various ways, with charitable foundations forming the most common means. Billionaire Albert Yoltschi signed the giving pledge in 2012 and later died that year. It was reported that in his will, he made the condition that nothing would go to charity if there was no U.S. estate tax. Since there was one, he followed through, moving that money to his own charities. This is also interesting as a general correlation. A study done by the Tax Policy Center in 2003 found that the estate tax encourages charitable giving at death by allowing a deduction for charitable bequests, and also encourages giving during life. The center calculated that if the estate tax was removed, there would be a reduction of charitable giving upon death of up to 37%. While the Congressional Budget Office corroborated this finding and added that during life, the same class would also reduce giving by up to 11%. What this means, first of all, is that the giving doesn't appear to be entirely genuine. We can understand a poor family donating to charity, knowing they can write the donation off their taxes if the deduction is itemized. They might not be able to afford the donation otherwise. The wealthy have no such excuse, and sociologically that is quite interesting. What they are really doing is bypassing state funding in favor of their own interests, moving money to charity foundations, effectively consolidating wealth in the hands of private interests rather than government, is a logical method to better keep things in the club of private business power. Keep in mind, the state is deeply flawed, as noted previously. But at least the state has some basic formal responsibility to the public, regardless of how corrupted it may be by vested interests. The giving pledge is partly just another avenue for this anti-government and hence anti-social behavior. In the words of German multimillionaire Peter Kramer, an open critic of the giving pledge, "It's all just a bad transfer of wealth from the state to the billionaires." So it's not the state that determines what is good for people, but rather the rich want to decide. That's a development I find really bad. What legitimacy do these people have to decide where massive sums of money will flow? That runs counter to the democratically legitimate state. Pablo Eisenberg, a senior fellow at the Center for Public and Nonprofit Leadership, said regarding the pledge, "What concerns me is that no one has said what the pledge is going to do, who it will serve, and how it will be accountable. It will increase the number of mega foundations, and I worry that will hurt our democracy because of the influence these institutions will exert." These are legitimate social concerns, given how such high-level, unaccountable private power is similar in effect to that of regulatory dictatorship. This is something deeply obscured in prevailing views of capitalism. While the world still seems to associate markets with freedom and democracy, the very structure of private business is actually in direct opposition to both. In the words of political economist Robert Brady, "Within the corporation, all policies emanate from the control above. In the union of this power to determine policy with the execution thereof, all authority necessarily proceeds from the top to the bottom, and all responsibility from the bottom to the top." This is, of course, the inverse of democratic control. It follows the structural conditions of dictatorial power. The accelerating rise of private charity foundations have the same flaw, as they can set their own public health and social standards, bypassing public participation in areas that require it. Inequality machine. As expressed, the socioeconomic system produces predictable outcomes in social psychology, and better understanding the characteristics of the upper class is specifically important. After all, it is this class that indisputably dominates social affairs. Again, this has nothing to do with deliberate conspiracy or the like. It is simply a systemic result inherent to the logic, values, and structure of capitalism. The sense of superiority naturally cultivated by the upper class, coupled with measurable losses of empathy, compassion, and ethics, makes the condition of modern power highly troublesome. The more people become rewarded by market economics, the more they tend to identify with the market, assuming its integrity. Hence, the rewarded wealthy are naturally the last to be critical of the very system that allowed for their flourishing, and they are certainly hesitant to change it. Such is the historical nature of class conflict itself. Yet, it goes deeper than elitist behavior or general policy administration. Mechanisms of social oppression come in many complex forms, some of which are built directly into the architecture of the social system, something referred to as structural bigotry. Building upon the idea of Stokely Carmichael's institutional racism, structural bigotry recognizes mechanisms in the social structure that create and reinforce social oppression indirectly. Unlike the aforementioned personality distortions and system loyalties of the upper class, guiding biased behavior almost subconsciously, these indirect mechanisms tend to go unnoticed. At least bad decisions and policies of biased politicians or corporate leaders can be exposed and, ideally, corrected within the realm of political or legal action. However, these more indirect mechanisms tend to go unnoticed or misunderstood. By indirect, I mean they are engaged in a procedural way without deliberate intent to cause harm. This involves the interaction of essentially everyone in society. We are all pulling levers on a giant machine, and the consequences of these actions go far beyond our localized perception, making our ability to comprehend the outcomes difficult. Structural bigotry is about relationships and reactions, not necessarily individual decisions or events. While one may argue that a government's tax policies are structurally oppressive, if they favor the rich by allowing loopholes, reduced maximum rates, and so on, it isn't exactly structural by my definition, as tax policy is actually designed to change and commonly does. What I am referring to goes deeper, and I will focus on two mechanisms. The first has to do with the incentive psychology inherent in market behavior itself, and the structural interplay that naturally leads to highly unequal outcomes and ultimately injustice. The second mechanism is slightly more obvious than the first, addressing the nature of the monetary system itself, specifically the existence of and dynamics related to debt. These are both structural in that they are interactive frameworks engaged by everyone with very little objection. You will likely not see voter referendums related to them, protests in the street, or official governmental meetings about altering them in root form. Rather, what you do see are constant protest movements and public outcry against the chain reactions created by these hidden structural mechanisms. Again, society is constantly battling symptoms, not causes. For example, to revisit a subject from Chapter 1, at the time of writing, there is a growing social movement in America called Black Lives Matter, which protests for justice and seeks solutions to a modern epidemic of racially charged American police brutality and general discrimination. The work is very much an extension of the 1960s civil rights movement in America, and eerily so. To really understand the origins of such problems as police brutality and discrimination, one must look beyond the current political environment, specific police department policies, or even the lone mentality of the individual perpetrators. The problem is sociological as opposed to political or moral. These sociological issues stem from early economic practices, namely abject African slavery. Like an infection that is constantly reinvigorated by contaminated conditions, racism between black and white culture has continued as a form of class conflict long after abject slavery ended. In fact, classism is really racism's father. In the words of Dr. King, racial segregation as a way of life did not come about as a natural result of hatred between the races immediately after the Civil War. There were no laws segregating the races then. The segregation of the races was really a political stratagem employed by the South to keep the Southern masses divided and Southern labor the cheapest in the land. You see, it was a simple thing to keep the poor white masses working for near-starvation wages in the years that followed the Civil War. Why, if the poor white plantation or mill worker became dissatisfied with his low wages, the plantation or mill owner would merely threaten to fire him and hire former Negro slaves and pay him even less. Thus, the Southern wage level was kept almost unbearably low. As such, impoverished white society was forced into competition with the now semi-free impoverished black society. This sparked a complex reinforcement of in-group, out-group fear, an exacerbating bigotry that has pushed racial tensions ever since. Coupled with the consolidation of poor blacks in urban areas after segregation, with reduced means and options, the focus of law enforcement has been disproportionately targeting blacks and minorities to help meet arrest quotas because it is easy given how vulnerable and often desperate those impoverished communities have been. From there, the racial profiling begins to take on a life of its own, and suddenly a white cop, who likely has many black friends and doesn't think he is racist, still conditioned by his experiences, impulsively shoots a black man in a middle-class neighborhood with no viable provocation. The racism is ingrained in his mind through a web of influences, literally stretching back hundreds of years. Yet, activist communities still tend to fragment things in a more localized way, missing deeper connections. While we cannot go back in time to change the history of economic slavery to stop the toxic chain reactions that brought us to where we are today, we can, however, change the current conditions that continue to preserve and inflame those traditionally bigoted associations. This is something Dr. King knew well as he pushed his Poor People's Campaign of 1968. He understood that if we could just remove general poverty, easing desperation and labor fear, many of the pressures and associations creating racial bias would dissipate. It is not a complete solution, but it would help. As will be detailed in Chapter 4, Racism, Bigotry, and Xenophobia, including resulting consequences such as minority-targeted police brutality, are ultimately linked to mechanisms of economic inequality and its consequences. Until economic inequality and its causes are reduced or stopped, bigotry and social injustice on many levels will continue as a systemic result. In fact, as I will also argue, positive social trends that have occurred have a good probability of reversing in certain ways as looming negative social and ecological pressures mount. I have little doubt that if our business-as-usual socioeconomic practice remains, the growth of bigotry, race-based or not, will continue to accelerate rather than decline. Rational choice. Now, the first class-dividing structural mechanism to discuss has to do with the inherent gaming logic or so-called rational behavior demanded of the market economy to ensure survival. This is again about the shared incentive psychology of the interacting masses. While the generally caustic nature of competition itself was already touched upon in the previous chapter, the issue here is specific to the actual dynamics of mass competitive behavior. What is to be found is that inequality and oppression are systematically reinforced through the market's most basic, trivial, incentivized gaming behaviors, regardless of the personal intentions of people. In the prior chapter, utilitarianism was introduced. This idea of people seeking to maximize their utility or self-interest in economic decisions was further codified in microeconomics by rational choice theory. This is defined as an economic principle that assumes individuals always make prudent and logical decisions that provide them with the greatest satisfaction and act in their highest self-interest. This simplistic principle raises difficult philosophical questions about what exactly rational or prudent decisions are, and to what degree they are rational and prudent. What exactly is self-interest in the long run? For simplicity, let's divide market decision considerations into two categories, primary and secondary. Primary considerations have to do with the root incentive logic of markets. This means reducing costs and maximizing income. Each of us orients our economic behavior this way in general, from buying discount clothes to selling off the old family car for the highest possible price to running a company. We naturally seek to maximize our income and reduce our expenditures as best we can. In fact, most do not even think about this procedure today, as it is so customary. Every day our lives revolve around the abstraction of minimizing costs and maximizing gain. Secondary considerations are actual real-life considerations, such as gauging how your actions may tangibly affect the well-being of others and the environment. These decisions enter the realm of morality or ethics. Do you buy slave-harvested chocolate or clothes made by children in sweatshop conditions because they are less expensive, even though your purchase is maintaining abusive labor demand? Should your company use a cheaper part in a product to save money and increase profits, even though it will prematurely break and contribute to waste and pollution? Should your company maximize the price of a scarce resource in a poor region to ensure optimized profits, even though it may further impoverish the locals? Primary considerations are abstract considerations, made irrespective of real-world conditions. They are morally or ethically life-blind, which is why secondary considerations are needed. For example, a company could dump toxic waste into a local water supply to save money on disposal, while also cornering their market through cartel power to sell their product at many times the market value, exploiting consumer vulnerability. While considered unethical, the logic is in perfect accord with primary market rationalization. When the Bayer Pharmaceutical Company willfully and knowingly sold HIV-tainted drugs across the world in the 1980s, killing thousands, simply because the financial investment in the product was considered too high to destroy the inventory, basic moral integrity was no doubt in question. But where do we draw lines in more subtle cases, where people succumb to undertaking negative behaviors not because they are malicious, but because the pressures of their circumstances require acting for market survival? When it comes to ethical assessments in the market game, the real calculation very often comes down to how much ethics you can afford, not what you think is morally correct. Once again, the root socioeconomic orientation of commerce is based upon scarcity. This means that regardless of the reality of the human condition, the market system looks for deficiency and seeks to capitalize off of it. This is built directly into the logic of every business decision by way of the primary incentive framework of reducing costs and maximizing income. All players are seeking advantage in every circumstance, fundamentally denying the well-being of others by strategic default. Therefore, the moral continuum resulting from primary market logic is already structurally biased in an inhumane or at best indifferent way. This makes whatever extreme of perceived moral violation merely a matter of degree. In other words, when it comes to primary rationale, there is no difference in principle between selling people HIV-tainted drugs to save money and increase profits and knowingly selling people cheap processed foods that contain sickness-causing additives to reduce production costs and make the product more affordable in the competitive marketplace. There is no difference in principle between exploiting the labor of an intern fresh out of college at minimum wage and exploiting the extreme poor in the third world for 2 cents an hour. There is no difference in principle between dishonestly selling a used computer that has a major hidden defect to a person who isn't the wiser, and a corporation selling factory new computers that have inferior quality components in them so the corporation can save money in the short term and increase profits in the long term by repeat purchases. In a system fundamentally based upon the exploitation of economic circumstances, morality becomes one massive gray area along a continuum of general social indifference. That understood, let's now extend this primary rationale from individual actions to interactive or systemic actions. In other words, instead of thinking about one person making such decisions, let's consider many people making them, interacting and competing with one another, as is the case in reality. Related to the equilibrium ideal behind Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, mass interaction based on primary market logic results in what can be called competitive self-regulation. Competitive self-regulation is about the dynamic of multiple interactive parties in trade producing mutually affecting systemic outcomes. It can be considered a sub-mechanism of market self-regulation, focusing specifically on competitive dynamics between agents. A simplified example is a store owner who buys goods wholesale and sells them retail. The prices he ends up selling his goods for are not randomly decided at whim. They are semi-determined based upon market factors, such as the cost of inventory and the prices set by his competitors. This economic interaction helps determine the market price of his goods based upon competitive self-regulation. This was already touched upon in Chapter 2. However, determining prices is just one of many consequential outcomes of competitive self-regulation. Returning to the foundation of systems theory from Chapter 1, by definition, systems produce consequences undetermined by the sum of their parts. The dynamics of competitive self-regulation are what link and turn individual human actions into collectively generated system-level outcomes. And these outcomes can arise with no direct intention on the part of the players. Again, this is very important to understand, as our world has been obsessed with ethical arguments to improve things, missing the system-level outcomes that have little to do with an individual's moral compass. The specific outcomes I would like to focus on here can be categorized as negative externalities. An externality is generally defined as a consequence of economic activity that is experienced by unrelated third parties, positive or negative. A common negative example is pollution. Oil businesses that pump, refine, and distribute oil products factor in only their internal financial costs of operation, generally basing their prices only on supply and demand. If pollution occurs, the costs associated with that problem, such as cleanup, are usually not factored in. They are external costs, and they will need to be paid by somebody. Yet, while from an economic standpoint external costs are to be measured in financial terms, these costs also far exceed something one could put a price tag on. In many cases, damage caused is irreversible, posing serious threats to entire ecosystems and to public health. And while certain industries or even specific companies can be sourced to certain problems, with legal actions taken to get them to change their behavior or cover costs, the deeper problems are those that cannot be easily linked to any single company or industry. They are system-level problems, and just about everyone is to blame to some extent for participating in the market economy itself. When we consider overall pollution, inequality, poverty, resource depletion, species extinction, loss of biodiversity, reductions in public health, civil conflict, behavioral violence, overall structural violence, and other pervasive social and ecological problems, we are looking at consequences not of one person, one institution, or one industry. We are looking at problems literally produced by economic behavior itself, like an old combustion engine constantly spewing caustic exhaust. These problems are really categories of problems, with one externality triggering many others. For example, imagine a company that over the course of years pollutes a water source to save money on proper disposal. That polluted water is linked to a town's water supply, leading some people to get cancer, not knowing why. In one family, this pollution leads to the sickness and death of a father. Since the father was the breadwinner, the widow is now trying to afford to take care of two kids. The financial strain increases their debt, with the oldest child then unable to attend college as he needs to help support the family, etc. You can see how chain reactions spread in complexity and are difficult to track due to unforeseen consequences linked to negative externalities. A defining characteristic of externalities is that they require actions outside of the market's primary logic for resolution. This is another reason why mainstream economists take such a positive view of charity. Since those who are homeless and poverty-stricken clearly have no money to buy things, charity is the only real option as a workaround. In fact, these system-level externalities explain why there are so many non-governmental organizations, NGOs, charities, activist groups, and nonprofits in the world today. These groups are mostly trying to help clean up the constant mess the market leaves in its wake. In essence, these organizations represent the secondary considerations mentioned previously, trying to correct the real-world consequences constantly created by the primary ones. Unfortunately, as will be detailed, no matter what such groups do within the existing socioeconomic system to help, problems resulting from these negative external forces will remain to one degree or another. Now, the central point here is how these costs, both financial and in terms of real public health, unequivocally hurt the lower class. As phrased concisely by Charles M. Kelly, author of Class War in America, negative externality is the fundamental reason we need regulations for every aspect of corporate activity that impacts the environment. However, the same thing can be said about all other corporate behaviors that transfer what should be their own costs onto workers, the economy, the taxpayers, or the community. The socialization of external costs, from big business to the general public, happens through taxation or subsidization and systemic servicing. By systemic servicing, I mean each related consequence has to be dealt with on a per-case basis, connected to a complex chain reaction, such as the example earlier with the father getting cancer. There is the financial cost of cleaning up the water source, medically treating the cancer, possible government income subsidization to help the family after the father's death, etc. These are difficult costs to track as they blend into the normal, everyday world of problems. However, they are not normal, and the literal costs of these externalities reach into the many trillions each year. For example, a 2015 economic report by the International Monetary Fund put the external costs of fossil fuel alone at $5.3 trillion a year, 6.5% of global GDP. This report attempts to account for extended health and environmental costs associated with fossil fuel use both on the side of the producer and the consumer, but not factored into its price. The Economist stated, "The fiscal implications are mammoth. At $5.3 trillion, energy subsidies exceed the estimated public health spending for the entire globe." Their general use of the term subsidies is not to be confused with direct government subsidizing of fossil fuels, which is about $500 billion a year. Rather, it is about the collective costs, including systemic servicing, that have to be paid in general, distributed across the population. More dramatically, in a 2013 report on behalf of the Economics of Ecosystems and Biodiversity, TEEB, program sponsored by the United Nations Environmental Program, it was found that, in fact, no major industries in the world could be considered profitable from the standpoint of external costs. In other words, if our core industries actually had to pay for fixing the external problems they create, they simply would not be profitable. The major profits gained are occurring without regard for the long-term destruction they are creating. How all this affects the poor disproportionately is twofold. The first is the direct financial burden. The direct tax subsidies come from the public coffers that could be used to better help the poor, improve education, and expand other social welfare programs. While one can argue the lower prices obtained by subsidization help the poor as well, such that in some regions an increase of 25 cents per liter in fuel would reduce the purchasing power of a poor household by more than 5%, poor households actually account for only a small portion of total fuel use. The stark reality is that households with incomes in the top 20% get the majority of the financial benefits. At the same time, real-world public health and ecological problems fall predominantly upon the lower class. The most notable example is climate change, which is already affecting the poor across the world disproportionately. As Colonel Dervis of the United Nations Development Program concluded, "Ultimately, climate change is a threat to humanity as a whole, but it is the poor, a constituency with no responsibility for the ecological debt we are running up, who face the immediate and most severe human costs." Water pollution, which is largely attributed to industrial behavior, has been estimated to account for 40% of all global deaths. This negative externality and its consequences targets the poor overwhelmingly. On both the global and domestic scale, such as in the U.S., the well-to-do have the option to avoid polluted water supplies for consumption. The poor generally cannot afford such options and rely on basic infrastructure such as tap water or local reservoirs. These types of examples go on and on. The point being, while in the long run, pollution and other externalities can affect everyone on Earth, they will engulf the poor and lower classes first and foremost. This disadvantage furthers their individual economic inhibition and class suppression, not only by way of an increased economic burden, but by way of health and social problems as well. As a final variation of this analysis, externalities create economic imbalances that have chain reactions throughout the business network due to competitive self-regulation. Like a trapped air bubble being pushed around poorly hung wallpaper, shifting but not really going away, an unexpected cost incurred by one agent can start a chain reaction of adjustment across many agents. For example, imagine a tuna company that has been profitable and stable for some time. One day it is found that the tuna it has been fishing is highly polluted with mercury. This mercury pollution is an externality coming from power plants nearby. People who have become sick bring lawsuits against the tuna company, and it loses business. The company cannot in turn sue the power plants for its resulting losses, as the tuna company is not directly in trade with the power plants, and hence the pollution is legally seen as an act of God. The tuna company is stuck with costly litigation, a need to shift its fishing to another region, and the loss of sales. So, bound by the law of competitive self-regulation, the company has to make adjustments in order to adapt and stay competitive with other tuna producers who are not weighed down by these external costs. Hence, the tuna company is now highly disadvantaged and perhaps even desperate. And with desperation, the gray area of what constitutes moral behavior in business starts to widen. Up until this time, the tuna company was held in high social esteem. It had clean boats with no fuel leakage, cared for workers with extensive benefits, and was even careful not to overfish to prevent depletion. However, with this new pressure, those high standards have to be lowered for the sake of company survival. So, the company lays off some employees, extends the hours for others, and reduces medical benefits. It also curtails equipment inspections and mechanical updates, while raising fishing quotas so it has more tuna to sell. While these changes return the company to profitability, new external costs have been created that otherwise would never have occurred. The employee layoffs have put more pressure on the city's unemployment insurance program, increasing taxes on the general public. The extended work hours result in more employee injuries, while the loss of medical benefits puts them and their families in debt, injuring overall financial health. The reduced equipment inspections and mechanical updates lead to equipment decay, and some of the boats start to leak fuel, causing even more pollution. Meanwhile, the higher quotas hurt the ecosystem, reducing tuna fertility and increasing regional scarcity. This scenario has immeasurable downstream effects. The point is that once an externality is set in motion, it can trigger many others as companies try to compensate for the disequilibrium. As financial stress increases, companies become less ethical as they try to remain competitive and profitable. And who suffers disproportionately in these corrective circumstances? The workers and, in general, the lower class. In fact, all debilitating influences that reduce market efficiency, regardless of what they are or where they came from, will hurt and suppress the health, income, and options of the lower class more than the upper class. This unfolding in turn maintains downward negative pressure. Such reality becomes even more frustrating when one realizes that no matter what the market system does, these problems will arise over and over again because the market's function is constrained by its own rational choice mechanisms. It creates negative externalities not as an anomaly, but as a constant, predictable attribute of its system-level behavior. All this is particularly alarming when we look at current large-scale negative externalities that are trending into more and more ominous territory. While this will be addressed in detail in Chapter 4, there is no doubt a sociological correlation